Who is it?
It's me, Miss Austin. Gregory, your new assistant.
I didn't even know I had a new assistant. Come in, Skippy.
I just wanted to tell you, before we get started, that Pride and Prejudice changed my life, and Northanger Abbey, and now I really love Emma almost as much as...
Put a sock in it, Skippy. Your whole vibe is starting to freak me out. Here, drink this whiskey, right now, right down the hatch. Attaboy, breakfast of champions. Now snort this.
What is it?
It's, let's call it anti-fainting salts. You do one bump, I'll do the other.
I feel very odd.
Just give it a few minutes, Skippy. The line you did needs to meet the whiskey you drank. Somewhere in there is your cruising altitude.
My what? Hey, why do you have a donkey head?
That's what I mean. Now you're somebody I can deal with.
What are my duties here?
Well, you've got to keep me on track for this novel, Persuasion. My publishers are screaming at me to finish it.
What's it about?
It's about everything, Skippy. This novel is a sock puppet eating the bloody heart of England. I've got the usual intelligent young heroine destined for spinsterhood, but she's secretly a Japanese admiral who blows her boyfriend's head off with a cannon. She journeys to the city of Bath, which is a giant pulsating amoeba, the colors of sunset.
I don't understand.
You will when you take this. Just let it dissolve under your tongue.
Okay.
You know what? I don't feel like writing right now. Let's have a duel, just to, you know, get the juices flowing.
A duel, Miss Austin?
Yeah, you take this pistol, I'll take the other one, and we'll walk off 10 paces, turn, and fire. You'll miss, and I'll wing you. Just take a tiny little chunk out of your arm. I'm an amazing shot, especially when I'm this high.
I think I have to leave.
I knew you were yellow. Have him send over somebody else. I'm bored. Here's a show about working for some other writer, Hunter S. somebody. And now the founder of Gonzo Urology, Colin McEnroe.
Yes, we're going to take a trip into the world of Hunter S. Thompson today. I did not know all that stuff about Jane Austen, though. It's a very different image than what I had of her. We're going to be talking to Shara Della Pietra. She is the author of Gonzo Girl. It's a novel, and it's a novel that's based on some of her time, her experiences as an assistant to Hunter S. Thompson out in Colorado, in his sort of his famous lair out there. So, and for those of you who don't know who Hunter S. Thompson is, how can that be that you don't know who Hunter S. Thompson is? But actually, in her book, she has a description of this character, you know, based on Hunter S. Thompson that pretty well nails it. She says, Walker's, that's his name, Walker Reed in the novel, Walker's literary niche, the blurring of the line between fiction and truth, coupled with scathing political discourse and an almost mythical ingestion of drugs, is his and his alone. You know, Cheryl, I was thinking about that too, and I was thinking about Thompson, whether there is, I mean, he's part of a tradition of American ecstatics, you know, that really goes from Whitman to Kerouac to him. But he's also doing something, and he's also like Norman Mailer and people like that, people who wrap himself into the story that he's telling, tell you the story of him telling you the story. But there is a way in which he's, you know, you're right. What he did was his and his alone. There's nobody else before or after who does it quite that way, right?
Right. I mean, he invented a literary form. I mean, gonzo journalism is basically putting this novelistic structure onto the truth and with some embellishments and that sort of thing. And in a sense, this book is also a little bit of gonzo journalism in that, you know, I put this narrative structure onto my real life experience.
Right. So you're blurring truth and fiction and kind of working almost from the other direction. He was a nonfiction writer who really struggled to write a novel.
That's right.
You're a novel writer basically using nonfiction. We'll come back to that, too. I think it's a really interesting point. But first of all, what's a nice girl like you doing in a place like that? How is it that you came as a very young woman to be an assistant for how many months was it?
It was about 5 months.
Yeah, for about 5 months.
That's right.
Which probably is about the normal lifespan.
There's like there was a dog year aspect to that, yeah. For sure. Yeah. Well, I was a recent college graduate. I went to the University of Pennsylvania, and I went to New York after to try to make my mark in magazines. And I ended up tending bar instead while I was freelancing, freelance fact-checking, that sort of thing. And I had a friend working at Rolling Stone, and he called me one day, and he said, Hunter S. Thompson's looking for an assistant. Do you want to throw your hat into the ring? And I said, why aren't you doing it? And he said, because he wants a girl. Mm-hmm. So I figured out what that meant later. Mm-hmm. But so I wrote him a letter that very day, and I faxed it. And this gives you an idea of the technology at the time. And he called me at 3 o'clock in the morning and he said, I really liked your letter. Can you get out here tomorrow? And that's how he did things. So I woke up the next day and I flew out to Colorado. And the funniest part was meeting him for the first time. He said, I'll be the one with the red umbrella. So I land in Aspen Airport, and sure enough, there he is with an open red umbrella in the middle of the airport, as if I wouldn't have recognized him otherwise. And then we were off to the races.
And off to the races actually makes me think of his Kentucky Derby, in which he refers to the mayor of Louisville as a swinish neo-Nazi hack named Louis Nutt. I don't know why that phrase stuck in my head, but it always has. So it's 1992, and in the novel and in your life, it was 1992. So this is really a time of struggle for him. This is he's not at his peak right now.
Correct. And, you know, that was one of the things I wanted to be very sensitive to when writing this book. It certainly portrays a writer in the twilight of his career. And I didn't want that to come across as irreverent, but I did want to get to all the complexities of the portrayal of him and his character, and kind of the double-edged sword of the substance abuse that kind of fueled his writing, but also, I think, contributed to, you know, in his later years, his writing not being what it was.
By the way, as we go along here, if the legacy of Hunter Thompson is important to you in some way, or there's some piece of his that touched you, or you have your own strong memory, give us a call, 860-275-7266. We'd love to hear, 860-275-7266. Or if you just have some burgeoning literary opinion about Hunter S. Thompson, happy to hear from you. You may also tweet at us at WNPR Colin. That's WNPR Colin. I'm not going to ask you like how much is real and how much is fake or anything like that. But there's the book begins with a kind of baptism by fire, right? Your character, who's more or less you, is at this house. There's his usual retinue. He's got a posse, basically. Some of them are paid and some of them are hangers on. Some of them are famous people who just want to hang out with him. And the famous people who wanted to hang out with Hunter Thompson included people like Jimmy Carter and, you know, George McGovern and people like that. They weren't all, actors or drug heads, right?
One of my favorite stories from being out there is Ed Bradley used to come by all the time, and I showed Ed Bradley how to boot up a Mac Classic. he said, what's this? And so he had a Mac Classic in the back of his office, which, of course, he didn't use. He used a typewriter still. So I showed Ed Bradley how to use one. but, you know, Bob Rafelson and, John Cusack used to call in. And he did have quite a diverse array of people who were interested in hearing what he had to say and hanging out with him, and very, very interesting entourage.
And the other thing that threads through this book is that, I mean, obviously, this retinue is there, and they are there to hear what he has to say, as you say, and partake of his wisdom and osmotically absorb whatever being Hunter Thompson at that point actually meant. But there's also – it's just a pretty much nonstop party, right? It's a pretty much nonstop drug and alcohol-fueled party.
Right. I mean, party is an interesting word because I think of a party as being totally fun. And this was an interesting time to be out there. I mean, he did so many drugs and drank so much, but it wasn't always fun.
Mm-hmm.
People ask, is all the drug use you hear about true? And I say, absolutely. It's truer than you would ever think.
Mm-hmm.
So it was pretty astonishing just in terms of his constitution to be able to get through a day and with everything that he was putting into his body and still sit down at night and sometimes produce two pretty amazing pages. Yes.
And the book also begins with this kind of Pygmalion-like sequence where he accepts Allie, your protagonist, more or less accepts her into this job, but then takes her once to reclothe her, buy her a whole bunch of outfits that sound kind of absurd and not very appropriate. And that shopping trip turns into a restaurant trip where this insane amounts of food. And I remember from reading some of his own reportage, he really liked to talk about that too, that just like what he would eat for our breakfast or something. And it would just be this ridiculous, Trimalchio-sized amount of food. So that turns into So this ridiculous experience at a restaurant that's also fueled with hallucinogens. And once again, I'm not asking you to sort of talk about a one-to-one correspondence, but was some of that true? I mean, did he want – was there kind of a Pygmalion thing at the start of it?
Yeah. I mean, when I first went out there, there was this three-day trial period just to see if we, you know, worked well together. I mean, it was basically to see if I could hang. And, you know, certainly, you know – yeah, the tennis dress happened, and but I think what he wanted to do was kind of introduce me to his world. And one of the things that happened in those first 3 days was we, you know, took some hallucinogens and driving up the mountain, and this is in the book as well. We come across some snowmobilers, and he takes a gun out of the back of his car, and he shoots it into the air, and. It wasn't a real gun, but they didn't know that, and why would they ever think it wasn't real? And then we end up getting pulled over by the police. And they eventually let us go. And then we went back to his house, and we shot exploding targets with a 44 Magnum. And this was all day three. Mm-hmm. So I think he did want to kind of indoctrinate me into that world a little bit to see, A, if I could handle it, and B, if we would have fun together.
So there in the book, there's a couple of things going on about all this. One of them is, it's said more than once in the book, well, he's an industry at this point. Mm. Walker Reed, at this point, he's an industry. He's not producing his best work anymore, but there are mouths to feed, is one of the phrases used, mm-hmm. right? That whatever it is that he's doing, he has to keep doing it. Even irrespective of whether, I mean, here's this guy who paradoxically, you know, kind of struts as one of the most self-directed people you could ever meet. This guy who has invented his own life and does whatever he wants to do and indulges whatever appetite he has, and he has a lot of appetites, and that's all very real. But there's also this sense in the book that he's also doing a lot of stuff he doesn't want to do because, not just because of himself, but because there are other people who have needs and expectations. I'm assuming that was a very real perception of yours, too.
Absolutely. And he certainly knew what his public image was when we went out. He would put on what I call the armor, which is, you know, the Tilly hat, the aviators. He would have his, you know, cigarette filter. It was like, you know, putting on a costume to put on a show. So he was certainly aware of his public image and of his, you know, he would never have used this word, but of his brand. Mm. And, you know, in the public eye, I think he had, you know, we see in the Doonesbury cartoon, he had this kind of cartoonish persona, but you know, what I was trying to get at in the book was that this is a real person, mm-hmm. and kind of the complexities of his you know, his substance abuse, his writing life, and this kind of management of his public image.
And that, yeah, there were assistants and other people who had salaries, and that he apparently felt some kind of responsibility to keep that whole thing going.
Right, absolutely.
Since you alluded to this, I should declare, put one of my cards on the table, say my freshman counselor in college was Gary Trudeau. So,
okay.
And I know that Thompson, I don't know how much he got talked about in your 5 months there, he initially didn't like this caricature of himself in Doonesbury. I think he said that if he ever met Gary Trudeau, he would set him on fire. But that I've also read that over time he came to be kind of amused by it, or maybe just it became one more spinoff from this one-man human industry.
Sure. I mean, it's an iconic figure. I mean, Conan O'Brien thing where they're shooting out in the range, that video where he shoots, you know, that image of his own self. I thought that was rather poignant. But yeah.
So this is also, well, first of all, I have to say, I mean, obviously now your life is very different.
Yes.
You're grown up. You're not 22 years old anymore. You're a mom. You live in Branford. Mm-hmm. First of all, yeah, what's it like at the PTA meetings? I mean, are people reading this book and coming up and either wanting to know how much of it's true or wanting to tell you their own story?
I'd say this is the secret lives of the PTA moms, you know. It's very interesting. The Shoreline community has been so supportive, and everyone's very excited about it, so I appreciate that. support. But I think it also underscores this idea that, you know, we grow up to be adults, and we all have these pasts and past lives. And I think that's been the interesting part to hear from the PTA moms, like, well, you know, at the Grateful Dead concert and so and so, we did this, that, the other. And So I think we all have this kind of universal experience, this freshman year of life. You're right out of college. You have your first job. You're starting to experiment with certain things. So I think that's a fairly universal experience. And then most of us grow up.
I was going to come to that. So we're talking to Cheryl Della Pietra. Her book is Gonzo Girl. It's a novel. It's there's no mystery about whom it is based on. I think that's the other interesting question is that, so you're 22 years old, your protagonist is 22 years old. He's much older, but I mean, he is kind of a Peter Pan figure, right? I mean, he's this kind of gun-toting, coke-snorting version of Peter Pan. I mean, or did he seem that way to you? Like somebody who's just decided, well, what if I don't have to grow up? What if I don't have to take on any of the traditional burdens and responsibilities?
Well, this is what I saw as part of my role, but also the role that women played in his life. When I was out there, he had a girlfriend. I was out there, he had a personal assistant. So there were three women out there basically nurturing. I think in the book I call it the care and feeding of the modern American icon. You know, our job was to sort of keep everything going out there. So, you know, personally, professionally, you know, eating three meals a day, that sort of thing. So I think that he made sure he had these people in his life to take care of him.
Yeah. What's interesting is that so he has this, I mean, he's this Pan-like figure too, right? He's just very committed to chaos.
Right.
And so three meals a day, well, I mean, the first thing we see you guys do is you go to this restaurant. He orders five porterhouse steaks, and those each one of those steaks is intended to feed two people. And then all this other stuff too. I mean, lots of other entrees and stuff like that. And the fact is the two characters are way too high really to consume much of anything. It looks like the fettuccine's crawling across the table. But then it sort of comes home, and when it all gets taken back to go, this $1,500 order for two people goes back to the Colorado cabin, and there's a sense then that maybe these domestic goddesses take over and carve all this up and make it into actual meals.
Right. Yes, we had a lot of leftovers, but he really used to order like that. And not only that, one thing I sort of forgot about that I didn't put in the book was he used to have so many condiments, salt, hot sauce. And I think, honestly, you know, his palate was a little bit shot, you know, that he really needed the food to have flavor. So there was a wide variety and lots of condiments.
And so being one of these domestic goddesses, so what's clear in the book is that he doesn't keep all these roles quite as delineated as one might hope. You know, there isn't sort of exactly girlfriend, assistant, other kind of assistant, right? I mean, so was he chasing you around the table out there in Colorado?
In what way?
Any way you want to interpret that question?
No, but there were these moments, quieter moments of that were very intimate. That surprised me, and one that comes to mind. There, this appears in the book, maybe not in sort of a more fleshed out form. But there was one night he's like, let's just lie on the couch and relax. So we're sitting there kind of spooning and talking.
John Nankoski does that with me sometimes. So I know what that's like to have.
You know, kind of spooning and talking. And it was a very sort of intimate, friendly moment. And nothing's, you know, sexual about it. But it was those kinds of things that were rather surprising was the things that weren't crazy. The morning coffee and, you know, reading the paper over morning coffee and watching CNN. You know, morning being, of course, you know, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. But those were sort of the very special moments to me.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's an odd thing about both Thompson and your character, Walker Reed, too. They're as exotic as an American human of the 20th century could be imagined to be. But there's also something very pedestrian about his interest, right? I mean, he really liked sports a lot. Mm-hmm. He really was kind of a TV news junkie.
Absolutely. And this is when CNN was kind of, you know, 992. So he had CNN on constantly. on the background, usually with the volume off, and then every once in a while something would catch his interest and he'd turn it up. He used to read a lot of newspapers.
And you were catching him, and this is there in the book a little bit, you were catching him at the that time around 92 is, well, any time was probably interesting for Hunter Thompson. He tended to be interested in things, but he's watching the rise of Bill Clinton.
That's right.
I will be talking a little bit later to one of his liaisons at Rolling Stone. So he wrote about Clarence Thomas right around that time too, right?
Right. And watching being there in 92 during a political campaign, I say it was like watching the moon with Neil Armstrong, you know. It was very special to, arguably, I think his strength was writing about politics. And, what ended up coming out of the time I was there was the book Better Than Sex, which was all about the 92 campaign.
Mm-hmm.
We were trying to work on a novel called Polo Is My Life, which was never published. But he just couldn't help himself mm-hmm. once the campaign started. And this was, with Perot and Bush. So it was interesting.
We're going to grab a little break here. When we come back, we're going to talk more about this novel, more about Hunter Thompson, the writer. You'll hear from, as we go along today, another voice who had strong ties to Hunter Thompson and many dealings with him.
I know what you mean. Blinded by a quart of rum and a dose of mescaline.
Writing was the only thing that you knew you could do that satisfied you.
Well, I could get paid for it.
They didn't pay for the other
stuff. Yeah, and then when I learned about newspaper work, I learned that you can work for a morning paper. You can work late at night. You can go to work at 2 o'clock and get off at midnight or so. Once you learn that, I can't imagine going back.
Did you create a persona for that you thought would serve you?
Serve me?
That was you.
I'm afraid if I created it and crafted it and made it, that's giving me too much credit.
So that, of course, is the voice of Hunter Thompson and the voice of Charlie Rose. With me in studio is Cheryl Della Pietra. Her book is Gonzo Girl. It's a novel based on her time with Hunter Thompson. We've got a tweet from Bill. HST's book was, quote, the least accurate and most truthful book about the 72 campaign. Oh, Frank Mankiewicz said that, I guess. Then Bill says, for me, that sums up Hunter Thompson's legacy. It is sort of a great way to look at it, and it's what we were talking about at the beginning of this conversation, Cheryl, too, is that he was a writer of nonfiction who struggled to write fiction, right? I mean, a lot of what's going on in this book, a lot of what was going on in 1992 was, it's odd, too. We did a show about 3 or 4 years ago about projects that were either unfinished or really, really hard to finish. And I don't know why we didn't think of Polo as My Life, because this is the book that even had its, what are they called, ISBN or whatever.
That's
it actually
right.
had a commercial registry number, right? It was that close to existing.
That's right. Well, there are a few novels that he was working on. His very first one was called Prince Jellyfish. That also was not published. The second one was The Rum Diary, which a lot of people don't know. He started The Rum Diary in 1960, and that wasn't published until 1998, and that was after Fear and Loathing Las Vegas movie came out and Johnny Depp signed on. Actually, it's a very good book. And then Polo Is My Wife was another one, unpublished. I just think he had a hard time, I think. His real life was just so very interesting. I just think he had a hard time just making things up, that he would rather have lived the interesting thing. I mean, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas certainly reads like a novel.
Mm.
There are certainly parts of that that I hope are embellished. I have this very interesting quote from him. In 1965, he said, "If I'm ever to be worth anything, I honestly think it will have to be in the realm of fiction, which is the only way I can live with my imagination, point of view, instincts, and all those other intangibles that make people nervous in my journalism." And so this was sort of a precursor to what he eventually created, which was gonzo journalism, where he could kind of play with both forms.
I think also he had this comfort level. By the way, as we're going along here, we're talking about Hunter S. Thompson, and we're talking about Gonzo Girl, which is Cheryl Della Pietra's book about working for Hunter Thompson. If you want to call in, if you have your own thoughts, memories, opinions, theories, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266, or you may tweet at us at WNPRCon. A little bit later in the show, we're going to talk to Corey Seymour, senior editor at Vogue and co-author of Gonzo, The Life of Hunter S. Thompson, with Jan Wenner, and he was Thompson's liaison at Rolling Stone. The other thing about this is that, you know, I think most of us who want to make our living in journalism or working for magazines or whatever it is, I mean, there is this sense in which you need to cooperate somehow, you know, whereas you are your employers, they have most of the power. There's more people who want to write than there are spaces to put the writing. Mm-hmm. And so you kind of learn all these various habits and you learn how to hand things in on time and, you know, and the same thing when you're writing books. I mean, well, we've all handed in manuscripts late and stuff, but not that late, you know, and sooner or later, you just don't. I never believed, and I'm sure you don't believe, that that industry, whether it's magazines or book publishing or whatever, will have infinite amounts of patience with me or will. But there are certain writers, and he's maybe the pirate king of them all, mm-hmm. who basically just sort of thought, I can just keep getting advances for stuff, right? I mean, one of the things that's there in your novel that I find myself even wondering about is everywhere he goes, he's just peeling big stacks of $100 bills off right. This roll he keeps with him. He hasn't really had a literary success in a while at that point, right?
There were financial troubles when I was there. That's that's very true. And I think what was the shot in the arm, so to speak, was, the Fear and Loathing movie with Johnny Depp. It certainly brought his work to a new audience. It raises his profile. I think it made him a little bit more mainstream. And it certainly led to other things like Rum Diary and then Rum Diary the movie. So I think the addition of Johnny Depp in his life changed things around a little bit. But, you know, you read all these really funny stories about the expense reports he used to turn in, just like thousands and thousands of dollars for all sorts of things, you know, like, you know, 2 dozen grapefruits or whatever it was. And certainly he was writing at a time when magazines were king. I mean, that's not the case anymore. It's big budgets, big, big name writers. That's just not the case anymore. But I think that people knew that they were going to get something very unique from him that no one else could ever possibly do. So they put up with an awful lot.
You know, we're going to talk to Corey Seymour in just a second. But before we do that, has this book also put you in touch with other people who kind of passed through his orbit pretty much the way you did? I mean, we should say that you were the fortunate assistant who didn't get shot by accident.
That's right.
He actually shot. Brady was trying to scare a bear away from her.
I'm sure it was a bear. Well, what's interesting is that someone in my hometown who worked at the National Observer with him called me up, which I thought was amazing. People forget sort of before, I would say before 1970, you know, he was a struggling journalist. He worked for the National Observer in the early 60s, and he lived and traveled in South America writing about American foreign policy there. I mean, he was a very straight-ahead, journalist. I also did hear from a former assistant of his, which I thought was this was a very interesting conversation that really only the two of us could have. She said, "You really nailed it," I appreciated that. She said, "You really nailed the day to day."
Back to the National. I think it was the National Observer where he got fired from there. I think I have this right because they at one point had him doing book reviews because I think they were freaked out by everything else that he did. They had him doing these book reviews, and he wrote a review of one of Tom Wolfe's books, and it was glowing. It was positive. And there was somebody there who'd had a run-in with Tom Wolfe, one of the big bosses there who'd had a run-in with Tom Wolfe. And so they killed the review. And his reaction to that was to send the carbons, this is back in the days of carbons,
right.
send the carbons to Tom Wolfe with a note, who he didn't really know, with a note saying, this is the review I wrote. somebody here has a grudge against you, so it's not going to run, but I wanted you to see it because it's a great book and you're a great writer. And somehow or other, word of that got back, you know, and that was regarded as kind of an act of treason. Mm-hmm. And this is very much him, right? This is like he really is somebody who would invent conflict if there wasn't one to be had.
I guess that's one way of looking at it. I think that he was a very loyal person, and he was a deep truth teller, and that he would see that as kind of, you know, BS, you know, that he, you know, this is what he wrote. He liked it, and he should know about it. So I look at that a little differently. But I think the letter you're talking about is in The Proud Highway. I'm not positive. I feel like I've read that. But that's a wonderful collection, his letters, which I will also say is, you know, a dead art form. His collections of letters edited by Douglas Brinkley are truly amazing. Proud Highway and Fear and Loathing in America. Really wonderful. You really see how he formed these deep friendships with, you know, other writers and friends. I mean, he was just an extremely loyal person.
Towards the end of the book, your protagonist is thinking about the fact that she wishes that they'd stayed in touch. I'm assuming that's you again, that you didn't stay in touch after this.
Not very much. When I very first left, I went back to Connecticut and I did an outline for another book for him for a month. And the working title on that was 99 Days, The Trial of Hunter S. Thompson. And it was all about when he was accused of sexual assault. That was actually, I think it was in Songs of the Doomed. He writes about that at the end. And in that, this was when...
it was a case in 1988, I think, or thereabouts anyway. This is the one where the woman claimed that he had fondled her breast.
That's and right. Stuff. That's right. But then that led to a search of his property.
Right. And they found dynamite and all kinds of
dynamite and, as you can imagine, drugs and... so he was actually, there were 8 counts, I think 5 of them felonies, and eventually the case was dismissed. But it was, you know, sort of classic Thompson in that he, you know, was all about personal freedom and you know, you should be able to do what you want to do in your own home. So I thought that was an important case. So I outlined that book after I left, and that also was never published. But the last time I saw him was in 1998. I went to the Barnes & Noble in Union Square. I was living in New York at the time. And Halloween, he was reading from the Rum Diary and signing. And I stood in line like everyone else with my book, and I got to the front of the line. And he looks up at me, and he grabbed me, and he pulled me over the desk, and he starts giving me a noogie right in front of everybody. As you can imagine, it's Halloween in Union Square. There are hundreds of people there. And then he said, "Stay over there. You're coming out with us." So I said, "Okay." So we ended up going out that night, and Benicio del Toro was there, you know, to Gramercy Tavern. And that was the last time I saw him in person. So we did part on very good terms, and I was glad about that.
All right. We're talking to Cheryl Della Pietra. What we'll do is we'll take a break. We're going to add Corey Seymour to this. Oh, actually, no. No, let's take the break. Let's take the break. We're going to add Corey Seymour to this conversation when we come back. Talk a little bit more about this man's life.
Hunter S. Thompson, Oscar Wilde. We've got the best drugs for miles. Hunter S. Thompson, Oscar Wilde. I'm just trying to make you smile.
I don't see how I'm supposed to do these announcements with all these wolverines and iguanas in the studio. What do you mean you can't see them? They're everywhere. Today's show was produced by Katie Talarski and me, Kyone Wolf. Our interns are Nate Gagnon and Zachary LaSala. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. The part of Bill Curry was played by Johnny Depp. For show pages, articles, and photos of the Faith Middleton Show staff's annual 3-day porterhouse steak and cocaine party, visit our website WNPR.org/Colin. On tomorrow's show, Black Holes. And now, back to Colin.
The journalist who is not detached, who becomes involved. In fact, he was almost an honorary member, you know, or a dishonored member of the Oakland Hells Angels. You were with them for about a year or so.
About a year, yeah. They claim, the Angels anyway, claim that they don't look for trouble. You know, they just try to live peaceful lives and be left alone. But on the other hand, they go out and put themselves into situations deliberately and constantly that are either going to humiliate somebody else or cause them to avoid humiliation by fighting.
You speak of foul fighting. They stomped someone. You were stomped. In which there isn't a question of rules involved here. Just beating some violence for the sake of
violence.
Well,
they have a rule. It's bylaw either number 10 or 11. It says when an angel punches a non-angel, all other angels will participate. So I was a victim of bylaw number 10 or 11. Yeah. I should have known that. You know, yeah. It's a lapse of caution. All during this stomping, I could see the guy who'd originally teed off on me just out of, you know, from nowhere with no warning, circling around with a rock about, oh, must have weighed about 20 pounds. I tried to keep my eyes on him because I didn't want to hit my skull fracture.
Your observations are more than about the angels. They're about our society. And it's since World War II, pretty much, isn't it, this phenomenon's come to be?
I think the angels came out of World War II. And this whole kind of alienated, violent subculture of people wandering around looking for, you know, either an opportunity or, if not an opportunity, then vengeance for not getting an opportunity.
So that's, of course, Studs Terkel talking to Hunter S. Thompson. That's conversations taking place in 1967, so 30 years before the Charlie Rose clip that we played for you before. And that's got turned into a blank-on-blank video. You'll be able to see it, I think, on our website, WNPR.org, after the show today. So with us in studio, Cheryl Della Pietra. She's the author of Gonzo Girl, a novel about her time, a novel based on her time working for Hunter Thompson. Joining us now also, Corey Seymour, senior editor at Vogue, co-author of Gonzo, The Life of Hunter S. Thompson, with Jan Wenner, and published in 2000. He was also Hunter S. Thompson's liaison at Rolling Stone. Corey Seymour, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
And you can say hi to Cheryl. I think she and your husband have some kind of...
Hey, Corey.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. Great to hear you.
Yes, you too.
So, Corey Seymour, I want to sort of go back to the beginning in a way and just talk a little bit about who Hunter S. Thompson was before he became Hunter S. Thompson. This is really, you know, we talk about a self-made man or a self-created man. This guy is a really self-created man. This is a man with really limited amounts of education who ultimately turned himself into a certain kind of literary titan, right? Where did he come from?
He came from a place that nobody has ever visited before, I think. It's the funniest thing, or the most sort of illuminating thing, pardon my voice, I have a bit of laryngitis, is going back to Louisville and talking to his childhood friends that he grew up with. From the youngest age, virtually all of them will say that he was unlike anyone that they'd ever seen before. He did things his own way from the earliest age, and he was always very kind of naturally intelligent, and he was always very charismatic. He had a constant crew of friends and sort of hangers-on waiting for him to walk out the front door of his house when he was in grade school. And together they would set off on adventures, they would light things on fire, they would start fights, they would cause trouble. It should also be said, or noted very prominently, that he also insisted that at least once every week he and all of his merry band rode their bikes to the public library and sat down and read quietly together. Like, he was always very big in learning, in education, as well as the sort of well-known stuff, which is the hell-raising stuff.
Right. In fact, there was something called the Athenaeum or something, that some group of literary people that at a very young age he did connect with there, right?
Absolutely, yeah. It was a literary magazine that was centered around the very prestigious high school that he went to school, where he went to school. And it was a social coup to be elected to be able to join the Athenaeum, and it was certainly an academic coup. And he joined them. He wrote, did some creative writing for them, and he sort of worked on a very, 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 very early prototype of what would later become this Gonzo voice. And the thing that it certainly wasn't over the top in the way that we knew his writing later on. What it did have the kernel of, in terms of Gonzo journalism, was that it was very focused on the individual. It wasn't sort of an attempt to fit into anything. It was really its own sort of thing, which was that kind of singular perspective that he brought that later, when it sort of achieved its full flower, became Gonzo journalism.
So, and then, you know, it seems to me one of the other turning points for him, it turns out he doesn't really get conventionally educated, but in the military, he discovers that if you can be a journalist, your whole schedule changes, your whole ability to do what you want to do changes, and you can control your life a lot more. And he becomes, in particular, a sports writer, right, for the Elgin Air Force Base?
At least ostensibly, yeah, that was his that was his racket, yeah. And that was journalism was, pardon me, I guess sort of ticket to the inside for Hunter. He wanted to be where the action was, and if you want to be where the action was, you either are sort of you're running that action, you're sponsoring the event, or you're, you know, the person in the game. He wasn't that guy. But he found that through journalism, he could sort of be freelance and go where he wanted to go. What he did when he was covering sports, though, in his odd fashion, was he wrote about, rather than the sort of ritualized way in which we discuss sports, and sports are kind of a stand-in for issues of, you know, strength and character and honor, he wrote about pro wrestling events as if they were actually real rather than these kind of stage spectacles. So he was writing about people, and he, of course, he exaggerated. And so he would write about people, you know, tearing limbs from limb and blood flowing everywhere through the ring and people screaming horrified. And it attracted a lot of attention. At the same time, I think he realized people actually published this. And I think it blew his mind to realize that he could write this sort of outrageous thing, which he was expecting to be fired for immediately, and people thought it was funny or interesting, or they just didn't care, and he could keep on doing it, and he kind of pushed that envelope farther and farther out there.
I want to get a little of a sense of what it was like to be Thompson's liaison at Rolling Stone. First of all, how many years were you in that position?
10 years, off and on. I worked at Rolling Stone for a part of that. I worked at Men's Journal magazine, which is also owned by Rolling Stone, for another part of that. But the interesting thing about working for Hunter, at least at Rolling Stone, is that once he liked you, which was not necessarily a given, or, you know, it had its own problems getting to that phase. But if he liked you, he was extremely loyal. And so Hunter didn't really care if I worked at Rolling Stone, if I worked at Men's Journal, if I worked somewhere else. Once I was working with him, he wanted me to always work for him. And that meant, you know, the 3 a.m. phone calls and, you know, I would just get these urgent messages from Colorado that, you know, Hunter's coming to town and needs someone to meet him at the airport, and you have to have a box full of fruit and a fifth of Chivas. You know, after a while, you sort of know what you need, and you have an inflatable sex doll. And first, it becomes very shocking, and after a while, you know, you're telling your friend, "Oh God, Hunter's here. I have to go buy a fifth of Chivas and a box of grapefruit and a blow up sex doll," and it seems very normal to you, but. Something Cheryl said, I heard a little bit of your chat with Cheryl earlier. She was talking about Hunter's financial situation and the expense reports and things like that. Part of my job was putting those expense reports through our internal system at Rolling Stone, and there's always a great effort on Jan Wenner's part to restrain Hunter's expenses. And no matter what we did, we really couldn't do it. I mean, there are ways of camping down in it, but we sent him to the Breakers in Palm Beach for a second installment of a story that we actually never ran, but it was supposed to be a second excerpt, if you will, of this Polo is My Life book he was working on. He never really put it together, but that didn't stop him from submitting expenses of tens and tens of thousands of dollars. We got some, I don't know, like a $45,000 hotel bill from the Breakers for a stay that was only like 12 days or something like that. But one of the line items on that expense account report was, it simply said, on the Breakers expense bill, it said, incinerated sofa, $12,000. Just lit his sofa on fire. He also took black cans of black spray paint and drew what you and I would sort of anecdotally call giant swastikas on the white carpet, but in fact they were Hopi Indian symbols because the arms on the cross like thing were going the other direction. But things like that are a little tricky to pull off when you're sort of trying to work on Hunter's behalf and actually get him paid for these sort of things. So I tried to trickle them through over a period of weeks and months rather than all at once and hope that nobody really paid attention. But that only works for so long.
So, Cheryl, I'm going to ask you this, partly so that Corey can have a sip of water or tea or Chivas or whatever he's having there. But You know, in the book, your character Allie, near the end of the book, I mean, she's asked to make a drug run for this character, and there's a way in which she suddenly realizes that she's not in a Peter Pan universe. That it might seem like a Peter Pan universe, and maybe it works that way for Peter Pan himself, or Walker Reed, or Hunter Thompson, but that ultimately she won't necessarily be dealt with that way if she gets pulled over. Or did you have that kind of experience with Hunter S. Thompson, where you suddenly thought, oh, well, he can do all this stuff. He can do the kinds of things that Corey's talking about now, set couches on fire and spray paint Hopi Indian symbols on the carpet of a very expensive hotel, because he's who he is and he's kind of famous for testing those limits. I'm not famous for that. Something bad really could happen to
right,
me.
Right, right. It was very easy to feel like you were in a movie out there. that scene in the book actually is true, and it was a big turning point for me. It's certainly a turning point for the character in the book, where you realize, wow, people who do drug runs are drug dealers, you know, or, you know, this is not who I am. Mm. So it was sometimes very hard to divorce these things from you know, what the experience was like out there, because everything was so heightened all the time. Everything was so intense. And in some ways, it all felt very much okay to be doing all these things, because it was utterly sanctioned. So that's a big turning point for the character in this book, realizing this is not, you know, who I am and what I want to be doing. So,
you know, in the minutes we have left, I want to quickly ask both of you, and this is a hard calculation to make, but, you know, obviously, if there had been no Hunter S. Thompson, there would still be a Chuck Klosterman, and there would still be, a David Foster Wallace doing the kind of nonfiction writing that he did, and there'd still be a Jonathan Franzen. On the other hand, there's something that he did, right? Something that he did that nobody else did that may have created a certain amount of literary space in which other people now operate. Corey Seymour, do you have any thoughts about that? Sort of what ultimately he did that has a lasting impact on the world of letters?
Sure. I mean, in terms of his contribution to, or his part in the so-called new journalism or gonzo journalism, what he did was, and the milieu in which he did it, which was the counterculture. Certainly Tom Wolfe has written about the counterculture. Ken Kesey has written about the counterculture from various positions of being inside of it or outside of it. Hunter was absolutely at the center of that counterculture from his time with the Hells Angels through the period that sort of evoked in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. He chronicled its rise, he chronicled its peak, and he chronicled its fall. And he did so from within it, and his ability to write about the drug experience from within the drug experience, which is incredibly difficult to pull off as a sort of literary feat. It's very easy to engage in kind of hyperbole about it, but to write about an acid trip and have it be a real piece of writing. At the same time, to do that equally as well from inside the belly of the beast of politics is astounding. And to treat politics as a sport, as a strategy, as something that's live and vibrant, I think maybe his legacy will be richest in what he did in terms of our coverage of politics, which up to that point was a pretty dead art form. People received talking points from the candidates. People followed around the candidates and wrote in a very straightforward fashion about what they did. Hunter and his reporting assistant, Timothy Krause, who later wrote the book The Boys on the Bus, which was entirely Hunter's idea, and they worked together on it. The two of those guys got on that bus looking like Hunter did and acting like Hunter acted and immediately transformed politics. And not simply by dint of wild behavior, but by beating everybody else with the scoops, with the insights, and with their predictions and analysis of what was going on.
Cheryl Della Pietra, author of Gonzo Girl. Unfortunately, we only have about 40 seconds
okay,
left.
Okay, sorry, never mind.
No, go ahead.
I would just like to add to that that, you know, I do think gonzo journalism being so immersive, in some ways it was a precursor, an echo. Here we have with social media, the eye, the focus on the self. So I think there's some of that that we're seeing now. And I agree with Corey completely on the political writing. He was so incisive. So many of predictions came true. 1965, he predicted Ronald Reagan was going to be president. And I mean, you know, and his writings after 9/11 on 9/12 are utterly amazing. A lot of that came to pass. So I agree with both things.
All right. The book is Gone Girl by Cheryl Della Pietra.
Gonzo Girl.
Gonzo Girl. Oh. Well, it should enjoy the success of Gone Girl. That's what I say. Corey Seymour also is the author of Gonzo, The Life of Hunter S. Thompson. Thank you both for joining us today.
With the intention of arriving safely in a pretty and well-preserved body, but rather to skid in broadside in a cloud of smoke, thoroughly used up, totally worn out, loudly proclaiming,
"Wow, what a ride."
You my new assistant?
Yes.
Great, snort this.
Okay.
No. I want you to snort with curiosity. Can you make it more regal? Ugh, no! Next assistant!